Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, the editor of Total Film, and welcome to the subscriber version of Inside Total Film. And thank you, subscribers, for being there. We really do appreciate it. And today I'm joined by our production editor, Erlinger Ennison.
Hello.
And our contributing editor, James Mottram.
Hello.
This week we're talking about the apparent saviours of the US box office, Tom and Jerry, Francis Lee's Ammonite, World War II thriller 6 Minutes to Midnight, and the Neeson gentleman's Tuscan cosiness, Made in Italy. Shall we kick off then, literally and figuratively, with this?
If a picture of this mouse is tweeted up to Instabook Face or TikTok, we will be ruined.
No, sir, that's not gonna happen. That rodent is toast.
So that's Tom and Jerry, animated creatures in a live-action movie. Where are we finding the cat and mouse this time, James?
They are in New York. Tom has arrived with his keyboard. He's doing a little bit of a con by being a blind keyboard player when we first meet him. He then runs into Jerry. They end up at a hotel called the Royal Gate Hotel, a very posh hotel. It's about to stage a kind of society wedding. Arriving at that hotel at the same time is a character called Kayla, played by Chloe Moretz, who herself is a bit of a con artist. She kind of wangles her way into a job assisting at the hotel. When they discover a mouse is at the hotel, there's obviously huge panic. You can't have a mouse in a hotel. So she employs Tom to get rid of the offending Jerry. And then chaos ensues.
The kind of chaos we come to expect. Is it something that people are going to want to watch, considering that Easter holidays are coming up?
I've got to say, I actually went on set for this. And I must admit, I was a little sceptical coming into watching it. And there were things I really didn't like about it, such as the kind of annoying hip-hop soundtrack, which just did not feel very Tom and Jerry to me. But I did like the animation. The way you would have it sort of integrated into the live action, you might see, for example, a goldfish in a goldfish bowl on the desk of someone, and that was animated, and obviously the rest of it was live action. I thought that was really well done, and it did capture the spirit to some degree, not perfectly, but to some degree of the original cartoons, the kind of bonking on the heads, sort of lumps coming out of people's heads, that kind of thing, lots of sort of craziness, sort of skeletons when people get electrocuted, things like that. So I kind of enjoyed it. I thought the actual story, the kind of hotel set story with the society wedding was a bit lame. That wasn't really that exciting, but it was nice to see Tom and Jerry.
But I mean, we should say they established the rule straight out the gate that all animals are animated. Everything else in the world is live action. So that's the sort of rule that they keep up. But do you need the live action, Erlinger? I mean, why can't we just have an animated Tom and Jerry movie?
I watched it and I was, you know, I put it on and I was ready to hate it because I felt the same. Why put the live action element in there? And then it started and you had Pigeon singing, "Can I Kick It?" And I was turned around.
It
got me. Yeah, it had me at Pigeon singing an 80s hip-hop song or 90s hip-hop song. And it is immensely stupid. It's full of wanton violence. You know, the story is a bit, you know, pants. But I loved it. You know, I belly laughed several times during that film. But then, you know, maybe I'm easily pleased with silly gags and stuff. But I loved the soundtrack. I thought it kept like the action scenes really, really vivid and kinetic to put this very New York hip hop soundtrack to it. Like all the artists were New York artists. You saw this progression from like retro hip hop to a very recent DJ Shadow song in the final scene. And there was clearly some thought put into that. And it had that full throated confidence that I think you need when you're making a film as silly as this is. It's a movie where Michael Peña walks a giant cartoon dog voiced by Bobby Cannavale down a New York street.
And, you know, and one of the best jokes is him, just his reaction to a dog's fart.
You know, Michael Peña, it's a weird role that he has. You know, he's reacting to what I imagine is tennis balls for most of the film, you know, which are then replaced by cartoon animals. And same for Chloe Moretz. And, you know, their characters are underdeveloped, but they give it full willy and it keeps the film alive throughout for me. Mm. And you have to ask yourself as well, like, what's the film trying to do, you know, and does it succeed? And for me, it did.
James, you were on set and that set is not in New York. They filmed that.
No, and I was actually watching some of the kind of hotel bedroom scenes where Chloe's character sort of interacting with this couple that are getting married. And I remember sort of, you know, the set itself, And then they had this incredible backdrop of New York. And of course, you know, it's blue screen. It's been, you know, we've seen it done in many, many films. But you kind of look at it and go, God, that's kind of amazing when you've seen it, you know, the way they put it together. No, I mean, I thought from a set point of view, it was incredible. But as to the question as to who this film is for, I'm not sure. Because, I mean, I it appealed to me from a sort of nostalgia point of view because I grew up on Tom and Jerry. I've no idea what kids who have been kind of reared on sort of sophisticated Pixar characters, let's say, will think of something like this. I mean, I guess really young kids, it will appeal to them, but maybe older ones, I'm not sure.
They shove some sort of jokes in for older kids and adults. There's a Batman joke. There's a, you know, someone says, oh, don't worry about him. He's just a little animated. Ba-boom.
Oh, I laughed so hard at that stupid, stupid joke.
This is so stupid, but it does work. So from a point of view of being a film for the family, and providing entertainment, which is, you know, in America it was released and it was a massive hit. It was basically people went to the cinemas in New York when they could, more on a renting privately situation rather than actually flooding the things. But it actually was a hit in terms of cinema. Do you think it's going to be a hit here?
I guess to a certain extent, we've not had a great deal of big screen knockabout spectacle for a while. So, yeah, I don't see why not. We're still waiting for the cinemas to open, but it's quite a lot of fun. But, yeah, I must admit, I came on this pod thinking I was going to be the only one that liked it, and clearly I'm not. So it's got some sort of appeal.
It's not tiresome. That's the worst thing. When you watch kids' films and you're like, oh, I'm just watching this and I'm really not enjoying it. Whereas I actually sort of went along for the ride with this, and it's so silly, as you say.
Especially when it looks like such a cynical cash grab. You know, it never gets tedious.
Okay, so I think we are recommending Tom and Jerry family viewing when you're stuck in the house continually, as you will be this Easter. And that is available on VOD now. Okay, so from one duo to another, it's Francis Lee's follow-up to God's Own Country.
Miss Annie.
I've often heard your reputation discussed in the Geographical Society in London.
Is there something you wanted, sir?
My wife, she hasn't been at all well of late. She suffers from melancholia. I want her to walk the shoreline with you, learn from you.
I'm not looking for an apprentice.
I would pay a premium for a private audience.
It's not easy work.
So this is ammonite. And what is an ammonite and what's the significance of it, Erlinger?
Well, ammonite is an ancient spiral fossil. It goes in a little spiral pattern and is widely found, especially on the British south coast. And this film is about Mary Anning, a fossil hunter or paleontologist who found lots of fossils on the south coast in the area around Lyme Regis, where she lived, in the 19th century, including a famous ichthyosaur that's on display now, I think, in the Natural History Museum. At that time, it was in the British Museum, but at that time, it wasn't attributed to her, and she only got recognition later, mostly after her death. And this is about her life living in rainy Lyme Regis, and the time Chaucer Ronan's Charlotte comes into her life.
Francis Lee has said he's taken a real historical woman and imagined a possible romance for her, because there's no evidence to say she fell in love with a man or a woman, and who's to say, you know, what happened in her life, but that she did have very strong friendships with women and wrote great impassioned letters to women. So this is a sort of imagined version of a romance between Saoirse Ronan's Charlotte Murchison and Kate Winslet's Mary Anning. It's caused a bit of hoo-ha for pearl-clutching Daily Mail readers, hasn't it, for messing with history. But is it worth the hoo-ha? Is it a romantic, sweeping film? Does it work for you?
It worked for me to a large extent. It's tortuously slowly paced, which is, you know, kind of like a turnoff for people who are going to be wanting entertainment. But as a character study, I think it's fascinating. And like you said, it's not historically, you know, factual. It's imagined. But for me, feature films don't have to be documentaries or based entirely in reality. I think it's fine to imagine stories around people. And I think in this in this instance, it's respectfully done. Her legacy, I don't think, would be tainted by this film. Here we have a historical figure who there's no evidence that she had a heterosexual relationship. Why is it somehow weird to imagine that person in a gay relationship or within another context? But mostly, I think this film works on Kate Winslet's performance, which I thought was fantastic.
Which is very gruff. I mean, she is like a sort of fossil herself, isn't she? Needs to be pried open, chipped away at in order to find any sort of emotive feeling underneath. James, did it work for you? I mean, obviously, it's one of the comparisons you might make to it is Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Would you say this is similar?
Yeah, similar on a superficial level, I guess. But I thought Portrait was a much better film than this. Me too. It's always a problem when you see a director following up a first film, which was a remarkable piece of work, which in this case was God's Own Country. I can understand him making a bigger scale film with sort of quote unquote stars, which at the time of God's Own Country, of course, Josh O'Connor, as he might now be considered, you know, he wasn't then. I think he's kind of made the right career move to make, you know, a bigger scale story, let's say, or a starrier story. And as Erlinger says, Kate Winslet is fantastic in this film. I wasn't as sort of blown away by this as I was with God's Own Country, which I thought was such a sort of raw and powerful piece of work. Erlinger used the word sort of respectfully earlier, and I found that to be a word that really sums up this film. It's quite a tasteful piece of work in a way, and perhaps not as energetic as God's Own Country. I mean, it obviously suits the time, the period, the film, the story he's trying to tell, but kind of ended with a bit of a whimper for me as a film. I didn't dislike it, but I wasn't utterly gripped by it, let's put it that way.
Yeah, it's not something that sweeps you away, is it? It's a painterly film and restrained, and that restraint was too much. I wanted more bodice busting, for want of a better word. I mean, I think Portrait of a Lady on Fire was so romantic and emotional and passionate, and there lacked passion in this for me. And I disagree with you. I think Kate Winslet's performance is extremely one note. She is brusque and miserable throughout. I know we're supposed to see through Charlotte's eyes this woman and see the beauty in her. I couldn't see it. All I could see was a miserable woman with muddy boots who constantly hacked at rocks and was very, very sort of upset if you did your carrots wrong. I found that transition from two women who were sort of brusquely dealing with each other and sort of unhappily pushed together in this situation where Charlotte's husband has asked her to be sort of working with Mary to sort of ease her melancholy to passion in the bedroom. I couldn't see the leap from one to the other. That gradual romance didn't happen for me, and I didn't feel that seduction. So when they started having a romantic relationship, it didn't feel earned to me.
It felt very abrupt. I agree with you there. That it felt like there was a scene missing somewhere in that element of the relationship. And in a film that's not events driven, it is a character study. Maybe I agree with you there that you know, because it is entirely focused on Mary's character and Charlotte's to an extent, much less extent, but mostly on Mary's character, that evolution could have been smoothed out a bit.
I thought the setting was really nice, the sort of Lyme Regis area. That's not a place you see a great deal on film. And
French lieutenant's woman, James.
Well, that was 40 years ago, but yeah, good point. But you know what I mean? It's not seen so often, and it was beautifully detailed. The details of Victorian, late Victorian life were really nicely observed as well. So there were elements to like about it. I just didn't find it quite all connected up in the end.
Yeah, it's a handsome film without being a passionate one for me.
And the sound design, I was most struck by. The sound design, I thought, was pitch perfect, because you start with this stormy character and the sound design is full of stormy sounds. You know, the noise of the sea is overwhelming at the start. And the first few trips to the rocky beach with Charlotte, they're almost deafeningly noisy. And then when Mary's mood sort of smooths, the sound smooths out as well, almost imperceptibly, and the sea quietens down. And then when Mary's mood turns again, the weather turns again, and the whole soundscape follows Mary's moody evolution as well. And I thought that was absolutely gorgeous. But yeah. Again, it's not something to enjoy, it's something to appreciate.
Yeah, and you know, there's a museum, possibly. Yeah, and there's colour things going on, like the use of red is sort of a roadmap to where things are going and symbolising something. But then I think if you're trying to find things like that to like about it, you're not as swept away in the actual emotional journey of it. So for me, I'm just disappointed, I guess. I really wanted something as passionate and juicy as God's Own Country, because I absolutely loved that film. But it'd be interesting to see what Frances Lee does next, won't it?
Definitely.
So we are recommending it?
I am.
With reservations.
With reservations, James. Okay. So that is Ammonite, and that is available on VOD from tomorrow, Friday. Okay. More seaside adventures then. Shall we go on to this?
There's been an alliance between England and Germany here for many years.
What sort of Englishman would accept a post teaching Herr Hitler's League of German Girls?
Der Führer würde sagen, dass er nicht Manns bin.
Der Führer würde was sagen?
Mein Vater ist Deutsch.
I do not like surprises.
This is 6 minutes to midnight. James, what's that code for?
6 minutes to midnight itself, the title is a reference to the doomsday clock, which is a sort of symbolic clock that where the hand is set compared to midnight to how much danger humanity is in sort of man-made catastrophe. I think very recently in the Trump era, it was set very close to midnight. So in this time, it's actually set, we're in 1939, you know, the outbreak of the Second World War is imminent. The setting is an elite finishing school on the south coast of England. It's actually based on a real school, Augusta Victoria College in Bexhill-on-Sea, which Eddie Izzard, who stars and co-wrote the script, he grew up in Bexhill on trips to a museum. He sort of discovered that this school was actually a finishing school for daughters and goddaughters of kind of high up people in the Nazi party. They actually sent their offspring to this school. This is obviously before the war broke out, kind of unbelievable almost. And there was even a badge with a sort of swastika and a Union Jack, their school badge. So Izzard and co-writer, director Andy Goddard and co-star, co-writer Kellen Jones have taken this idea and sort of set a kind of espionage, Hitchcockian story around it. Izzard plays Thomas Miller, who is a British intelligence officer who's undercover in this school, trying to learn what's going on. Without giving too much away, there's sort of some German espionage activity going on in the school. Dame Judi Dench plays the kind of school governess, Miss Rochelle. At a certain point, Izzard's character gets framed for murder and then he's on the run. So that's where it goes on from there.
Yeah, I mean, this is basically, it feels like wish fulfillment for Eddie Izzard, doesn't it? He wanted to appear in 39 Steps or something, so wrote himself a role and stars in it. Does he work in this kind of role?
I thought he was good.
Oh, that's faint praise.
I thought he was good. But the film is very much a whistle-stop tour through spy movie tropes. And it never stops long enough at any of those tropes for you to get into the chase. The simmering tension at the start, and then you get this chase around different bits of English countryside, and then the culmination, which we won't spoil. And it makes it all a bit less tense than it could be.
It gave me sort of reminiscence of A Lower Low. There was something a bit sort of Dad's Army-y, I don't know, because tonally it seemed all over the place. It was trying for this noirish vibe, but then there was this odd sort of, you know, chase on a pier with a man wearing a swimsuit and bobbies in hats and sort of scattering people that went into some sort of sitcom territory for me.
Yeah, that was too slapstick for me.
It was just really tonally very strange. And then the sort of things that I hate, I don't know if you hate this, but it's a pet peeve of mine, when people write scripts about historical things with the benefit of hindsight. So like somebody says to someone, oh, if you lot get on the bus before Hitler invades Poland, I'll buy you all an ice cream. Like, come on, who's saying that in 1939? And one of his bosses says, stay in your lane, Miller. Who says stay in your lane in 1939? So things like that, when they're trying so hard to create this sort of very period vibe, and then they just throw it out the window with weird anachronisms, it drives me mad and pulls me straight out of the story. How did you like it, James?
Yeah, I think the same as you guys. For me, it's one of those films where the backstory is much more interesting than the actual story they've conjured around it. It's just a bit clunky. It's a nice cast. You know, Izzard does well in dramatic roles. I mean, 25 years ago, he did The Secret Agent, the Joseph Conrad novel, different era. But you know, he can work in these sort of dramatic straight roles, but yeah, it just didn't quite have the pizzazz that you want. To a certain degree, it was a little creaky from a budgetary point of view. I mean, you know, I don't really want to criticize it from that point of view, but at times you could see it sort of fraying at the seams. We should say Jim Broadbent turns up as well as a helpful bus driver that helps him along his way after he's been framed for murder. That character is actually based on Izzard's own grandfather, who was also a bus driver. Again, a nice backstory element that's more interesting than the character itself. Yeah, I kind of wished it was slightly more dynamic than it actually was.
I agree. And it also felt very much like it was a film. I mean, it was intended for the cinemas, but it's ended up on Sky. But it felt very much like a film that I'd always would have expected to be on a small screen. I don't know about you.
Yeah, oddly, I think it will probably fare quite well on a, you know, on a Sky Cinema sort of platform. I'm not sure how it would have fared in the cinemas, but I don't know. I mean, there is an audience for the sort of, you know, an old-fashioned espionage kind of romp. That's not necessarily, it's an older audience that might not necessarily be served so often these days in cinemas. It may well have done okay, or if it had a chance to come out.
Yeah, I think for that sort of audience, it's going to be enjoyable, but it doesn't reach very far outside that core demographic for me. But as you said, Eddie Izzard is a good actor and a good dramatic actor.
But not here, and you see, I didn't think.
Well, in the scenes between Izzard and Judi Dench, you see the quality. It might be that just, you know, Judi Dench's immense talent just rubs off on yeah, you know, you step up when you're opposite Judi Dench. Every scene between Eddie Izzard and Judi Dench is loaded with quality for me. And there are moments where it steps into cinematic territory, but otherwise I agree, it is a film better suited to the small screen.
Yeah, some of his line reads just recall the way he says stand-up.
A little bit, yeah.
That specific way he talks, and that was jarring for me. You know, he's like, so the Nazis are coming. Mm-hmm. You know, and it just really recalled the way he delivers his jokes, but he wasn't delivering jokes. He was delivering, you know, espionage information that could save the war effort, you know, and uncover, you know, spies in Germany. But the way he delivered it was a little bit one eyebrow raised. And yeah, tonally for me, tonally all over the shop. So I think we can say your dad's going to love it. And anyone who likes a war thriller is going to love it. And if you've got Sky Movies, you know, bang it on. But is it one that, you know, you're going to seek out?
If you watch that channel, Talking Pictures TV, which my father does actually watch obsessively, I think he probably, like you say, he probably would enjoy it, actually.
Yeah. My dad lives on the History Channel. He's going to be watching this. He'll love it. You know, Nazis and war, there's a Spitfire in it. Bingo. Done.
And a little slapstick chase on a pier.
And a little bit of a lower low. I mean, even one of the ladies is called Elsa. If you were doing a sort of comedy wartime German name, you'd have a girl called Elsa.
Actually rewatch an episode of A Lower Low only this week by chance, and it does stand up. So perhaps we could campaign now for a feature film version of A Lower Low.
I love A Lower Low. I love Herr Flick and the fallen Madonna with the big boobies. Obviously, Erlinger may not be aware of this cultural, iconic show.
Hello. I watched it religiously.
Did they show this in Iceland?
It was a big hit in Iceland, yeah.
Okay.
They never showed Only Fools and Horses, but Hello was a rerun favourite.
Good moaning. So that note, we will cautiously recommend that you see 6 Minutes to Midnight, which is on Sky Movies now. Okay, so, you know, a bit sick of the English seaside area. Shall we go abroad? Do we fancy a trip to Tuscany with the Neesons? Let's into this.
I don't hear from you for months. And then this sudden need to sell the Tuscan house by last Tuesday.
The house has been empty for 20 years. We just cheer the place up a bit and get it sold.
Tuscany is a romantic idyll. It's why all my clients come here. You have delivered me a building site whose walls seem to have been painted by Mussolini.
I wouldn't go on the bathroom if I were you. There's a large weasel in the sink. That's not a euphemism.
Okay, what's the plan?
Ferrato. It's like it's a rat boat, like
good teeth.
The size of a baguette, like a rat baguette.
So this is Made in Italy, starring Liam Neeson and his son, Michael. And they're playing father and son in Tuscany, aren't they, Erlinger?
They are indeed. Made in Italy is about a reclusive artist played by Liam Neeson himself, who travels from London to Italy with his long-estranged son, Jack, who is played by his real-life son, Michael, to sell the house he inherited from his late wife. That house has stood untended and dilapidated for years. They start work on the house. Robert battles demons of the past, while Jack meets a local restaurant owner, and the whole scene unfolds with a tedious inevitability.
Okay, didn't like it.
No.
I sort of have a soft spot for these sort of, you know, under Tuscan sun, Letters from Juliet, sort of Italian montage-y nonsense.
If they're as good as Under the Tuscan Sun or Letters from Juliet.
So this was as ropey as their house, was it, for you?
Yeah, it was. The snarky back and forth banter between Liam and Michael, it works. And it feels natural. You know, sometimes you get family members or real life, you know, spouses on screen and it just falls apart because real life chemistry doesn't always translate to the screen. But for them, it works. Mm. But for me, that was about the only good thing in the film. Every story beat was telegraphed from outer space. You know, we were about 20 minutes in when I could tell myself beat by beat what would happen for the rest of it. And unfortunately, that very predictable route wasn't marked with, you know, enough enjoyable diversions for me to enjoy it.
Was it good for you, James?
Well, first of all, I should say I went into this slight confession here not knowing that I knew it was starring Liam Neeson, but I didn't know that Michael Richardson was his son. I mean, shame on me for not knowing that. But
Richardson is a good clue, though, James.
In retrospect, yes. But Neeson would have been a better clue, to be honest.
Yeah, obviously, you needed Neeson to understand this. But obviously, he is the son of Natasha Richardson and Liam.
Yeah. But more to the point, I think I went into that with no preconceptions that they were father and son, which I think was quite an interesting way to watch the film. Obviously, most people won't have that preconception, certainly not now we told them. But I found it okay. I mean, I think it's a consequence of lockdown as well, of watching beautiful Tuscan vistas. The photography is great. It looks beautiful. It just makes you dream away about summer holidays. Yes, Erling is completely right. It's utterly predictable. You can pretty much work it out beat by beat. Right down to the sort of, you know, quick restaurant trip for some nice pasta and red wine, lots of joyful Italians, a makeover montage on the house, of course, at one point. None of it was startlingly original. Even the title is kind of a bit cheesy, but then I suppose it's not as good as Under the Tuscan Sun, but they'd already used that title, so they couldn't use it again. But yeah, I kind of had a soft spot for it, I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, it's rubbish.
It's rubbish, but I love it.
I didn't love it, but it's rubbish, but I knew what I was getting. I think if anyone's seen the trailer, you've seen the whole film for a start, but also you just know exactly what that is. And so because it wasn't pretending to be anything else and it wasn't attempting to be, you know, a Hitchcockian noir, and it tonally maintained exactly what it was doing, I was like, okay, I'm in. I'll have a glass of red wine and I will perhaps order a pizza and watch this and dream about, you know, being in a beautiful Tuscan village, eating outside with pasta and just olive groves and cypress trees. Yes, I'm in there. So for me, the sort of the escapism of it was fine and the sort of undemanding nature of it. But also, you know, I find it fascinating, the children of famous people. So I just enjoyed watching Michael Richardson going, oh, looks like his dad there, looks like his mum there. So that was an added element for me.
Yeah.
You know, comfort food for me in terms of just something undemanding and sweet, and it was fine. I wouldn't rush to watch it again. But I think if you're craving a little bit of escapism and something that doesn't tax you, it might be all right.
It's obviously written and directed by the actor James Darcy, who doesn't appear in the film, but you can tell it's a lovey film. It's an actor, it's an actor piece, really. And that's fine. And he's obviously an experienced actor, starred in Dunkirk as one example. And
was in Six Minutes to Midnight.
Yes.
Captain Drake.
It's James Darcy week, really, isn't it? He obviously understands what actors want. From that point of view, I thought that worked quite well. It was quite a well-performed piece. You got Lindsay Duncan popping up as a sort of dry estate agent who's trying to sell the house on behalf of the Neesons. There is a sort of particularly gruesome bit where this sort of awful prospective buyer turns up. I didn't particularly like that sequence at all. I found that sort of mildly stomach churning, sort of a kind of yuppie type who turns up in his Porsche or whatever it is. That I found a little bit too caricatured and didn't fit the tone of the rest of the film.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure those were actual cartoon characters.
Oh. Yeah.
There was a scene, there's like a moment of discovery by Jack that's full of genuine heart and emotion, and you can feel the real, you know, the tragic family history of Liam and Michael in that scene, if you know that history, and it also works on its own terms. But then it kind of reverted back to that sort of awkward, silly comedy after that. So it kind of undid that chance to win me over.
But it is interesting, as you say, that it does echo their real life situation. Obviously, Natasha Richardson died suddenly after a skiing accident. Michael was a young boy when that happened. And this sort of does echo that, which I'd be interested to know if it was written with them in mind. And also what their conversations were in taking on that project. Like, they can't have taken it on without thinking about how that would echo what they'd actually been through themselves. And from that point of view, it's quite interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. I suppose it's one of those films you end up speculating on, really, from that point of view. But I wonder if it did provide, I don't know, some level of catharsis to do the story. It's very hard to say and difficult thing to really speculate on. But interesting whether Darcy knows them well. I don't really know the background to it and whether he did write it with them in mind.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. But it is a fascinating sort of sideline of the story.
Yeah, because you do wonder, are these conversations some of the conversations they might have actually had, you know, because she sort of died suddenly whilst away, and I don't think Michael was with her. That sort of element of having a parent suddenly taken from you, they do discuss that quite a bit. So it is interesting to watch. Let's talk about Liam's art. It's not great, is it?
No. Although I know nothing about art, modern art, you see. It could be the best painting ever. It could be worth millions. I don't know. But
I have to say I was with the estate agent when she said it looks like it had been decorated by Mussolini, one of his art things. But it was supposed
to be
one
of the better lines, I thought.
yeah. It looks a bit like an angry Pollock, doesn't it?
Yes. But you know, Liam Neeson wearing the hell out of Cardies, isn't he? There's great Cardi game in this. You know, Matt Matum, who enjoys a rugged man's Cardi, would really enjoy this film, I think. I think we should recommend it to Matt Matum for his Cardi love.
He should have gone on set for it, really.
Exactly. So I think you get the sort of level at which we're talking about this film when we're discussing the Cardis and personal lives of the stars. It's not one that's going to live long in the memory after watching it. But if you fancy a bit of an Italian getaway, this might be the one for you. And it is hitting Amazon this Monday, the 29th. That's it for this week. I mean, I think we're just all basically waiting for cinemas to reopen and schedules to get back to normal, aren't we? But before we go, we've got time for a reader's question. And you'll like this, Erlinger. Why did they bother to put any other songs in the best original song category at this year's Oscars? Surely Eurovision can't be beaten. And what's your favourite Oscar-winning song? Can that song be beaten? Is that the winner on the night?
It might be beaten, but it shouldn't.
It shouldn't.
No, it shouldn't.
So
a part of it is sung in Icelandic, not entirely grammatically accurate, but they make a good effort of it. And I'm rooting for it personally.
I'd like to see it performed as well on the Oscars, because they are doing the Oscars for real, aren't they? Everyone has to get a test and turn up, and you're not allowed to Zoom your thanks in if you win. You know, I think we could all do with, you know, Rachel McAdams and Will Ferrell singing that with an amazing like stage display. Oh, you know, A Man in a Hamster Wheel would be lovely. What do you think, James? Any contenders?
I would love to see that. I really enjoyed that film. It seemed to have slightly kind of mixed reactions, but it made me laugh a lot. And again, it was a bit of a lockdown treat, really. So why not see Will and Rachel perform that song? I mean, I can't really see how that song's going to get beaten by anything else.
So looking at history of Oscar-winning songs, do you have a favourite?
I do. I looked at this question and I had an instant song came into my mind, which was Lose Yourself from 8 Mile by Eminem. That was my favourite, at least of recent times. I'm sure if I ploughed back through the years, there'll be some other classic ones. But that was a recent one I loved.
I agree. Lose Yourself. It's one that always stays with me when I think about like iconic best songs. It's both real quality composition and you know, speaks to the time it comes out in, and it feels personal and it's really catchy. It's probably always going to be my favorite best song winner.
I feel like I'm trapped in the 80s, because when I thought about it, all mine were like Up Where We Belong from An Officer and a Gentleman, and I Just Called to Say I Love You from The Woman in Red, which is a terrible film when you watch it now. it's one of those ones that has not aged well, but that song just was like a big thing in the 80s. And then I have to say, I've had the time of my life from Dirty Dancing. Come on. It's an absolute cracker. It's completely anachronistic for the film, which is set in the 60s. And then you've got this 80s power ballad at the end. But yeah, can't be beat for me. That's the one. So on that note, I think we'll just lead out with a lovely song. And for now, let's say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.